In this episode, I speak with Derek Jensen. Derek is a radical environmental philosopher and author of over 20 books. We discuss the underlying themes and message of his most recent published book, The Myth of Human Supremacy. We discuss the logic of human supremacy and the very real intangible intelligence and sentience of non-human life. We discuss how human beings have used their intelligence to rationalize the false assumption produced by our culture that we, the human species, are somehow superior to all other life on this planet, and that because we uncritically assume this, we allow the continued exploitation and rape of our shared living planet to continue unabated. In this episode, I ask the question, how long until we snap out of this delusional state of being our culture produces? We discuss this and much more in this episode. Derek, again, for his time and for his thoughts and for sharing them with me. I really appreciate that people are willing to take the time to express these ideas. And if you'd like to check out Derek's work, which I highly recommend, you can go to derekjensen.org. That's pretty much the base. You can find out all of his, find all of his books. You can find all of his lectures, his interviews, pretty much everything that he's done can be found on that website. So please check out that website. I'll provide a link to that in the description. And he also does hosts a weekly radio show called Deep Green Resistance. That is on YouTube. So you can find that again in the description. I'll provide a link to all this in the description. So please check that out. Also, if you enjoy this episode, I recommend that you subscribe to this podcast. It means a great deal if you do, and I'm currently in the process of setting up a Patreon account and maybe another method of providing donations to this project. It takes a great amount of time to set up these interviews, to produce and edit and do all the various things that are necessary to make a quality podcast. So, in the meantime, of course, just be on the lookout for that if you're interested in donating to this. I would really appreciate that. But in the meantime, just listen to these episodes. Enjoy them, like them, review them. You can find this on SoundCloud and iTunes. Also, it's on Facebook as well. So if you want to follow the Facebook page, Last Born in the Wilderness, that would be a good place to kind of keep up with updates and information and new episodes and segments that I release of those episodes. So check that out. And again, thank you for your time, and I hope you enjoy this conversation with Derek Jensen. So this book, of course, titled The Myth of Human Supremacy, which I think for certain people, they might not quite understand what that title even is meaning. But if you wouldn't mind explaining in your own words what that is, what the idea of human supremacy and why it is a mythology.
Well, the book starts with, I think this might be the first quote in the book, is that unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture. Mm-hmm. And I think the notion that humans are superior to and separate from everybody else is one of those unquestioned assumptions that is that guides this culture, that really, more than guides, it propels this culture. And, you know, so many indigenous people have said to me over the years that the biggest difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that, for the most part, even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really, really is. Mm. And they perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited, as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And it's long been clear to me that one of the primary uses of our intelligence is to rationalize our behavior. And if you want to exploit somebody, the first thing you need to do is you need to silence them. You need to pretend that they are somehow inferior to you. And so we pretend that non-humans have lives that are somehow less. That this tree outside this window, we pretend that this tree does not have a life that is valuable to this tree as mine is to me and yours is to you. Mm-hmm. And we pretend that this tree doesn't have interactions with its neighbors. And we pretend that that somehow... So I was doing an interview years ago with some reporter for Nature Online. And one of his questions was about how, you know, the natural world doesn't care if it exists or not, because only humans are aware of their own existence. So bears or trees or whomever else don't care if they exist or not. And they aren't aware of their own existence. And I said, wait a second. So at that moment he said that to me, this is literally true. The moment he said that to me, I was looking out the window and I saw a mother bear lying on her back in the deep grass with her two babies playing on her belly. And I said, you need to tell me that this bear is not enjoying the sun and this bear is not enjoying her children and she's not enjoying lying in the grass. And he said, yes, that's what I'm telling you. I said, have you ever actually seen a bear in real life? Have you ever had any relationship with bears? And he said, no, he had not. And it's like, if you just see a mother bear with her cub, which I see every day, by the way, in the summer, they love their lives as much as we do. And it just seems so clear to me that most of our philosophy and religion and everything else is basically set up to rationalize this underlying bigotry toward non-humans, when it's just very, very clear that we all have lives that are valuable to us, and we all make decisions based on the circumstances in which we find ourselves. It doesn't mean, by the way, that non-humans are somehow, that nature is like God, you know, a Christian God who's omnipotent and omniscient. The other day I was at my mom's house, and she has two dogs who have been together since they were born. They're brother and sister, and they are absolutely inseparable. They're very rarely further than 3 or 4 feet apart. And one of them wandered off to where he goes to the bathroom. They're outside. One of them wandered off to where he goes to the bathroom all the time, and the other one got bored, so she wandered off into the forest a little bit the other direction. And then she starts barking at something, and of course she's excited, so now he's excited. He comes running up barking, and it's a little bit confusing, but she wandered into the forest to the southeast. And because it's a forest, you can't always tell from which direction sound's coming. So he comes rushing up to me and then immediately heads west. Hmm. And then he comes back like, oops, she went over there. And then he runs back north. And he's not over there. And it's like, oh, I know where she is. And it always cracks me up to see non-humans. I mean, they're just like us. They make mistakes. They think about things. He's like, oh, where's my sister? I need to go hang out with my sister. Is she over here? Oh, no, she's not over there. And
yeah.
So when I say that non-humans have their own sentiences, I'm not saying that, you know, oh, the kitties have wisdom. They're just they're just beings, just like you and me, and they get in fights, and they, like, I'm looking at two cats right now, and they are sisters who've been together forever. I got them as rescue cats 5 or 6 years ago when their previous person died, and it cracked me up. They are lying literally on top of each other right now, which they do quite often.
Mm-hmm.
And, they will do this for a while, and then maybe once every couple of days, I walk into the room and I hear this hissing and yowling, and they're scrapping with each other. And it's like, this is everything you need to know about sibling relationships in all species. So my point is, they're just other beings. And of course, their intelligence are vastly different than ours. Like, how different it would be to, have a world based primarily on smell, or
mm-hmm.
there are these magnificently different intelligences out there. And I want to say one more thing about this, which is 25 years ago, I interviewed, Neil Everdon, a great philosopher. And at one point in the conversation, he was saying that he doesn't believe in this divide between, you know, significant humans and insignificant non-humans. And I said, well, where do you put the divide then? And he just looked at me and he said, why do you have to put the divide anywhere?
Hmm.
And that was wonderful, because it was, when he said that, I had this tremendous feeling of homecoming, that I could breathe now, because I could, I had validation of what I was experiencing every day and what I'd experienced my whole life, but which this entire culture had taught me not to accept.
Right. Yeah. There's two thoughts that I had, two points that I wanted to, that came out of what you said there. The first one is that, you know, you're talking about how we shouldn't idealize nature or these non-human beings that we are around all the time. And I think that that's something that comes from Western culture, you know, the culture that at least I can observe and I am a part of. I see it in everything. I see it in how it seems that Westerners seem to idealize or fetishize, or is also called, I guess, cultural appropriation. You know, there seems to be a lack of something in their own life, so they take something from another culture and they kind of appropriate it into their own life and into their own identity. So you see, you know, these young people or people that are older that tend to take in, like, say, Eastern spiritualism into their life, and they don't necessarily incorporate it fully because that would be too much. They still want to be, you know, a Westerner. They still want to experience the life of a consumer, I guess. But they'll kind of adopt some of these elements from other cultures and incorporate only certain elements of them that they like. So I think that comes into maybe our view of nature, where there's almost this, if you're not devaluing the natural world and exploiting it in a very obvious way, there might be an opposite thing that happens where people elevate nature to this, like, godlike level. They put it on a pedestal, like nature's just this it's inherently spiritual and beautiful and kind and generous, and it's, do you know what I'm saying? Like, there's not a realistic view of what it actually is, which isn't to devalue it in any way, because it's an incredibly complex and a very beautiful interplay between different species and forces, and it's a wonderful thing to acknowledge that that it is just as it is. It, you know, that there is no reason to treat it as this kind of abstract thing. And then the second point I just want to make real quick is that when you said that, we told that story about, you know, why does that line need to be drawn? Why do we have to have this division that doesn't need to be there? And I think in the book that when you mentioned that, you were referencing veganism. You were referencing this sort of belief, and it's a Western kind of idea that, you know, that only mammals and only animals that we can kind of identify with suffer, and that plants don't experience that, which is a false division.
Yes, I think it is. The plants suffer too, and they experience the world differently. But then again, cats experience it a little differently than I do. And, I experience the world more like cats than I do lizards because we are both warm-blooded. We're both mammals. Mm-hmm. And I'm presuming I experience the world more closely to lizards than I do to plants because at least we're both animals, which doesn't alter the fact that they don't experience the world and make decisions and have concerns. You know, I've been kind of freaking myself out the last couple of years because it occurred to me maybe 6 months ago that, okay, I think a lot of us have, you know, this is not like I think about this constantly, but I do think about, there is this sort of innate fear of being buried alive for humans. You know, it's like that claustrophobia would be very scary.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, okay, obviously plants don't experience that because their roots are in the soil. I mean, that's, if you're an earthworm, it would not be adaptive for earthworms to feel claustrophobic underground either.
Right.
And we know that earthworms have photophobia, that if light is shined on them, that freaks them out. And I've wondered, if you have a potted plant and you pick it up, I wonder if it gets a sense of vertigo.
And yeah.
The only time I think about this is like if I'm at my mom's house and she says, you know, would you move those plants around? I do it, you know, I don't freak out. But the whole time I'm just thinking, God, I wonder what this is like for the plant, which is really in many ways the question I'm trying to get at with a lot of this is just for us to expand our, we will never know what it is like. I mean, shoot, I don't even know what it's like to be you and you're another being.
Mm-hmm.
But we will never know what it's like to be a cat or, and I'm just saying cats again because they're right here and I'm looking right now to make sure she doesn't throw up yet again. So I guess we do know what it's like to be a cat. Whenever you do projectile vomiting, you can think, ah, now I know. Anyway, sorry.
It's all good.
but we will never know, but I think it's important to ask, what is it like to be you and what do you need? And I think those are really important questions because obviously we are not giving the world what it needs right now. We're thrashing through the world being, I mean, here's the real point is that a human supremacist attitude is just incredibly narcissistic. And it's incredibly ridiculous that, I mean, let's put this in terms of intra-human communications. And so I decide that I am superior to you because, you know, I can give any number of reasons, because I'm wearing a checked shirt, you know, or because I'm wearing corduroy pants, or because I'm wearing, or because I've got, you know, X number of books out, or because I have a degree in science, or anything. Those can all be means to declare that I'm superior to you, in which case you can go, gosh, that's really stupid. But when we apply those to non-humans, we don't, it suddenly doesn't seem quite so stupid. And the same thing has happened historically, by the way, that one of my books, Culture of Make-Believe, was in many ways about how the, it's about racism in many ways, about objectification. And one of the parts of it, I'm talking about the 1830s philosophers had a bunch of reasons, a bunch of rationales for slavery, chattel slavery. And one of the rationales, scientific, was that we know that the white people are superior to Africans because, and I'm not making this up, the length between the navel and the penis on a white person is greater, according to those scientists in 1830, which is why it's okay to enslave them. And of course, it's bonkers, you know, but this was taken seriously. And we also know that the reason it was okay to enslave them is because Jesus in the Bible never said a word against slavery, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we, in retrospect, can see how all these are just completely bogus and absurd. But when they happen nowadays, we know that we are superior because we make refrigerators. And it's like, that's pretty tautological. You know, we do something that we do, and then we declare it that's why we're superior. If there were anything other than our entire economy and way of life at stake, we would see how stupid this is.
Yeah. Well, it's pervasive. I mean, it is in everything. I mean, our whole economic system needs people to be distracted away from this obvious truth, you know? And it's interesting also, you were mentioning how science, seemingly science, was used as a means to, subjugate a whole other group of people based off of some arbitrary, you know, detail on the human anatomy, right?
Which may not be correct, by the way. I've never checked.
Yeah, right. I'm sure it's probably not correct. I mean, I've also heard that there was some small, I want to say it was like a divot or something in the skull of someone of African descent, and that meant that they were less intelligent. Like some trivial thing that they would use to, you know, give themselves like, oh, this is why we are superior. This is why they are less than us and all that.
You've gotten to the heart of the problem right here, which is the book really, in many ways, is about human supremacism, but it's really about supremacism in general. And the problem is that, if you are a supremacist of one sort or another, what you do is you find a difference between yourself and some other, and you claim that difference means superiority as opposed to difference. Mm-hmm. And this is true for men, for patriarchy, for men over women. This is true for racism. You find some identifiable difference, and it can be as small as the divot in their head. It can be the alleged divot in their head. It can be, you know, sex differences. It can be, the American Indians did not have the white concept of land ownership, and that was an explicit reason that it was okay to steal the land from. Same is true in Australia. Same is true around the world. So you find some difference, and then you use that difference to justify your exploitation of this other. And it doesn't matter what the difference is. And one of my whole points for all this is not to, and by the way, I just have to mention this because it makes me so upset and it's just so stupid. The postmodernism tries to declare then that this means that all differences are, artificial and socially constructed. And that's, that is just so absurd. The real solution to this is to recognize there are differences and to not use those differences as an excuse for a hierarchy. So a great example would be, I think it's a great example at least, which is one of these cats is black and one of them is gray. And they are actually different. One is gray, one is black. Those are physical differences. Mm-hmm. That does not make the gray kitty superior to the black kitty or the black kitty superior to the gray kitty. The bears walking around, some of them are brown and some of them are black. They're all black bears, the species. But some of them are cinnamon colored, some of them. And yes, those bears are different. I can tell by looking that one of them is cinnamon and one of them is black. But that does not make one superior to the other. And so the point is to not pretend that there are no differences and not pretend that plant intelligence is the same as human intelligence, but to recognize and celebrate the fact that they are different, but that does not mean that, and the question is, superior at what? Because the truth is that alfalfa plants are superior at fixing nitrogen from the air into the soil. They can do that much better than I can. And I am superior at carrying nutrients when I eat them, and then I walk through the forest and I poop them somewhere else. I am doing a much better job of carrying nutrients than an alfalfa plant could ever do. But that's fine. That's like saying that a timpani player is much better at making booming sounds than is an oboe player. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that the forest needs it all. It needs the nitrogen fixers. It needs bears or humans or someone to carry poop around and pop it out. And it needs someone to eat dead trees, and it needs someone to, I mean, there are all these different roles that different beings play. And part of our job is to figure out what that role is and then play it. As opposed to just lay waste to everybody who's different than we are. And that's really, in many ways, the entire point of the book right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, when you talk about the roles that each species or each individual creatures within those species, you know, that reminded me of an experience that I had, and I'm going to be pretty explicit. I was on a psychedelic trip and I was alone and it was at night. And I remember I was sitting outside and it was as if this information was kind of being downloaded. Like I was receiving some kind of wisdom or information, like some kind of self-evident truth. And I think I was thinking about the natural world and the different species that exist. And there was just this self-evident thing where it wasn't that anything was necessarily more important or less important than the other, but that each thing had their role that they needed to play in order for the entire system to function well so that everything benefits from it. And then I was thinking about myself and my fellow species, my fellow human beings, and the role that we were playing on this planet and this great system that we were very much connected to, but we were not aware of. And I had a real realization of like how important our roles are, like in our relationships to our friends and our family and our lovers, but also the roles that we play as organisms on this planet. And I know that seems kind of strange that it would have to take some kind of psychedelic experience to come to that realization. And I don't know what your experience are with substances like that, but the important the thing to get out of that, of course, is that I had a realization that everything plays a part in this whole thing. And it seems to me that pretty obvious that human beings have, at least I would say that human beings that are in the current mode of existence that we're in now, are not playing a very good role. Like we have somehow along the way forgotten what our role is supposed to be, you know? Like, and that's the disturbing part. Like when you come to that realization as an individual in this culture that when you participate in this culture, you are actively trying to push away that truth and that reality. That by going to work, by driving your car, by eating the food that you're eating, the way that we're eating it, just the very way that we're existing right now is like denying our role in the universe and on this planet. And I don't know what my question is with that, but I guess I was just trying to bring that up.
Well, I completely agree. And that, as a friend of mine often says, lies are very expensive to maintain. And that's why this propaganda has to be just hit at us continually, because the entire world is out there telling us a different story. And the only reason that we can, well, there are multiple reasons that we can continue in this way and ignore the messages that the entire world is telling us. One of them is the great line by Upton Sinclair, "It's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it." And I would change that to make someone understand something when their entitlement depends on not understanding it. If we understood, if we fall into that role, we will lose the comforts and elegancies on which this way of life is based. You can't have computers. You can't have anything based on mining and still have a livable planet. And that is really scary for people. And people would rather kill the planet than acknowledge this. And that's one part of it. Another part is that we are, is that we are driven insane by never interacting with the real world. And I love what John Livingston says about how, we often think of cities as places of sensory overload, and there's a sense in which they are, but there's a real way in which cities are places of sensory deprivation. Because, and not just cities, but most of us, most of the time, think about this, no, I'll back up. Think about this, colon. Most of us, most of the time, have most of our sensory perceptions either created by or mediated by human beings. And right now, I am, sitting inside, and I can see trees outside, but they're still, they're through the window. And the non-humans that I'm seeing, the non-humans I'm seeing directly with no glass in between us right now are two domesticated animals. And so everything I'm sensing, everything I'm perceiving right now is mediated. If we're sitting outside, then I could be seeing things with no mediation. But what happens when you're in an echo chamber? I mean, what happens when all of your perceptions are either created by or mediated by humans? What John Livingston used to say is that you start to hallucinate. And he believed, and I agree, that most of our ideologies are hallucinations. And what he means by that, or what he meant by that, he's dead. What he means by that is that we hear, oh, the stock market went up, the stock market went down. We hear about Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. We hear about all these things, and they're all strictly intrahuman. If you only hear human information mediated or created by humans, you can come to believe that that is what is important. Like, all of the so-called climate activists, they all have one thing in common, which is they say explicitly that what they're trying to save is civilization, not the planet. Hmm. Yeah. That is literally insane, being out of touch with physical reality. And we need to, that's one of the things that happens when, another way to look at this, and this is true for myself too, I was horrified maybe 15 years ago when I realized that I touch plastic more often than I touch human flesh. That's really scary.
Yeah.
And likewise, think about this. How many non-humans, how many wild animals or plants, how many wild beings do you, anybody hearing this, have a daily relationship with? And on the other hand, how many machines do you have a daily relationship with?
Hmm.
How many machines are within 30 feet of you right now, 20 feet? I mean, there's a microwave oven, there's a refrigerator, there's this computer, there's a stereo system, there are a space heater, there is the electric lights, I'm sure there's more. There's a water heater. Anyway, that's 30 feet of me. On the other hand, how many wild beings are within 30 feet of you? And how many of those can you identify? You know, I just said microwave. Can I identify what tree that is? I think it's a willow. Do I know what type of willow? No. What's that? It's a deciduous tree. Do I get points for that? What sort of deciduous tree? How the fuck would I know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so we are immersed in that. And so it's no wonder we don't think that the real world matters. I mean, for God's sake, this culture is killing the oceans. And there are stolid scientists who are saying the oceans could be devoid of fish within 30 years. And they're moving their forecasts forward. This is on the ocean planet. And yet there seems to be only about 35 of us who really care. it's completely.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I'll go, say, with my friends, we'll go eat sushi or something. And maybe that topic would come up because it's something I find, of course, worth talking about. But, I mean, obviously I'm a hypocrite. I'm sitting there eating this, you know, tuna.
Make you a hypocrite at all.
You don't think so?
No.
No?
Not at all. Because, okay, I'm going to tell two stories about this. One of them is that 20-some years ago, I was talking with my friend Jeanette Armstrong, Okanagan Indian writer and activist. And I said, oh, my God, I feel so terrible. I drive a car. I'm responsible for global warming. And she got really stern, and she said, do not take responsibility for what you didn't do. Your responsibility is to take down car culture. You and I were both born into this system. And this system, right now, where my butt is less than 30 yards from a salmon-bearing stream that just has a few salmon in it. And salmon should be so thick that you can walk across the back on their stream. That's what it's supposed to be like. And even as late as the 1930s, the Klamath River was so full of salmon. The Klamath is the second biggest river on the west coast of the United States that empties into the Pacific, after Columbia. It's a huge river. And it was so full of salmon that they said it was, quote, black and roiling, the entire river. And last year, there were so few salmon, this year, there were so few salmon that the Klamath Indians had their salmon festival without any salmon. That's how bad things are. Now, the point is, I should be able to walk 30 yards and grab a fish, and I've got food. I can't do it. Now, I'm supposed to feel guilty because I go to the grocery store because capitalism and industrialism have killed the salmon? I mean, it's supposed to be that we can... The accounts of the fecundity of this world before this culture arrived are heartbreaking. I would really recommend that you or anybody else read the book Sea of Slaughter, which has tons of contemporary accounts of so many fish in the North Bank that it would literally slow down ships. Ships could not pass through because there's so many fish. Whales were a hazard to shipping. The San Francisco Bay Area, I did a talk in the Bay Area a few years ago, and before I did a talk there, I looked up what the place was like prior to conquest. The early European explorers, early Spanish explorers, said San Francisco was, quote, paved with sea lions. And this is just, you hear this everywhere, 6 billion passenger pigeons in flocks so large they would darken the sky for days at a time, flying 60 to 70 miles an hour, and there were 6 billion passenger pigeons in North America, and they're all gone. They were eaten. And the local people could eat those. The Tolowa Indians lived where I live now, not a passenger pigeon, obviously, but salmon, for at least 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. If you believe the Tolowa, they were here since the beginning of time. It doesn't matter. It's a long time. And the population was about half in this county. Population was about half of what it is now. And they lived here for 12,000 years without destroying the place because there were so many salmon. And now the point is that we have much bigger responsibility. Okay, I'm going to back up. And when I was writing Endgame, this guy, I got in an argument with a guy who said that because I use toilet paper, I'm just as culpable for deforestation as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser. And that seemed like crap to me, and no pun intended. And I couldn't figure out why until one day I was walking through a forest, the forest here, and I was thinking about this, and I thought I'd ask a tree, I mean, how do you feel about this? And the tree said to me very clearly, you're an animal, you consume things, get over it. And then it said, here's the deal, you are responsible for deforestation, but not because you consume the flesh of trees. You're responsible for deforestation because there is a fundamental predator-prey relationship in the world, which is if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. Because if you don't, they will disappear. Everybody knows this. Everybody knows this role. We were talking about earlier people, non-human people, knowing their role. The mergansers know if they eat all the newts in the pond, there won't be any newts, and they themselves will have nothing to eat. And so... Bears know this. The bears know you don't eat all the salmon. If you do, there's none left. And they will go extinct themselves. And so, yes, you are culpable for the murder of the oceans, but not because you eat a fish. You are culpable for the killing of the oceans because you eat a fish and you don't stop the murder of the oceans. That's where you're, and my response, I'm not pointing a finger at you, this is me too.
Right.
That's where all of our responsibility lies. That if I eat the flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I have to take responsibility for the continuation of their community, and I have to make sure they continue. That is where our responsibility is.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I definitely understand that.
Cares. It's the system that makes you that. And sure. And this is a huge distraction. It's like stage magic. It's like prestidigitation. That what this gets us to do, all of us, is to put our attention at the wrong place, to put our attention onto you and onto me, as opposed to onto the system. And there's a really important thing happened in the 1980s, which is the first time that the newspapers, corporate newspapers, referred to human beings as consumers more often than it referred to them as citizens. And this is hugely important, because if they can convince you that you are a consumer and not a citizen, your choices for resistance are much lessened. As a consumer, your choices are consume and not consume, basically. As a citizen, you can consume, not consume, you can boycott, you can organize, you can pamphlet, you can write books, You can vote, you can not vote, and when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. That's if you're a citizen. And something else happened several thousand years ago that's even bigger, which is that we were converted from humans in a community who need habitat and have teeth and claws into citizens of a nation state where we have handed over the rights to self-defense over to the nation. And we have identified with the nation. And so I think it's really, really important for us to go backwards and all that. I mean, think about it this way, too. So let's pretend that you and I are living in 1941 Germany. Are we going to feel bad? And we're Germans. Are we going to feel bad? Is the primary thing we should do is to eat fewer potatoes because that will somehow stop the Nazis? It's like, no. What you do is you stop the Nazis. You do you proactively work. And yes, there's a very important role for food. You know, we have been made so we can't get food from the river, which means we have to have local food production. And as Kropotkin said, there are many revolutions that are foundered because of bread. You know, the system makes us dependent upon the system, and that's how it keeps us tied to the system and keeps us from rebelling against the system, is because it is what provides the literal necessities of life for us at this point. But it doesn't, I'll stop in a second, but that's another thing that I used to talk about a lot, is that if your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from the tap, you will defend to the death of the system that brings those to you, even if it's from the planet, because your life depends on it. If, on the other hand, your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, you will defend to the death those, because your life depends on it. And that's one of the things that has been hugely important in getting us to go along with this culture, is that we have, and this is true for any abusive system. This is true for abusive husbands who, you know, you get together with somebody. When my mom received her first beating when she was pregnant, you know, once she was dependent upon my father, then that's when he's got her. And abusers always do that, because that's if they are dependent upon you, it's much harder to leave. And that's true on the global scale as much as it is on the smaller scale.
Right. So, I feel like I wanted to bring this up. I've talked to Guy McPherson, and I've been following his work for some time. I'm sure you're aware of Guy McPherson's work.
Oh, yeah.
So we have this specter of climate change, right? We have this looming, I mean, seemingly looming, I mean, it's, even though it's happening right now, but there's this perception that there's this almost incomprehensible thing that is happening on this planet, that may very well, you know, make our society, cause the society to undergo an enormous amount of stress and eventually collapse as a result of all the various things that are going to happen as a result of our planet warming. Of course, Guy McPherson takes it to the point where, like, hey, we may very well go extinct as a result of this.
Oops, hold on a second.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. Bye. Sorry about that.
No, it's all good. No worries.
Okay, so your question?
Yeah, so I was mentioning Guy McPherson. I was mentioning climate change as this kind of looming, nightmarish scenario for mankind. And as you have, I think you have probably talked about this as well as others, is that there's this human-centric view when it comes to that. This may very well cause, like I was mentioning the sushi thing. I think the point that I was making ultimately with that was that, I think maybe even you had written this, that there's articles that are written about how, you know, in the near future, you may not be able to go to your local sushi restaurant to get your favorite sushi rolls because, you know, the oceans are essentially dying, whether it's through over extraction of fish from the ocean due to, like, fishing or because of dead zones as a result of the acidification of the oceans due to climate change, and the carbon that we've put out into the atmosphere. So, you know, there's different, thinkers that have kind of proposed this idea that maybe What's going to happen is that when this catastrophe visits us finally, and people in the first world, you know, are basically forced to address what has been happening on this planet because it's going to actually affect their day-to-day lives. I mean, I don't know. I guess my question or my thoughts on this is, what is it going to take? I mean, I try to hold on to some sense of like hope, I guess, which is maybe foolish, but I hope that people will see what's happening. I hope that people will kind of snap out of the delusion that we are almost constantly a part of. I hope that people will realize that when maybe they're driving through the Pacific Northwest, like I was last year, I was in the Pacific Northwest and I was shocked. I mean, I drove through and it's this beautiful, lush forest. And then you just go around a curve and you just see these clear cuts, just these massive areas of this forest are just gone. And I feel like that hit me somewhere deep. You know, it was something that I couldn't, I couldn't comprehend it. I could understand it like, okay, people are trying to make money and this is blah, blah, blah. But I imagine if you were someone who was working in the lumber industry, and you were witnessing it happening, you know, I would hope that they would at least on some level feel that what they were doing was wrong. But obviously that doesn't stop people from doing that. It doesn't stop people from polluting. It doesn't stop people from living lifestyles that are actively destroying the very land base that we need to survive and to even live on a practical level, just on that practical level, beyond just the respect for all life on the planet, you know, just thinking about your life and how it affects you. You know, people can't seem to, there's something missing in human psychology. Like we can't seem, or maybe it's not psychology, but maybe it's how we specifically develop our psychology in this culture that we cannot see that far ahead. We can't figure out that that's detrimental to our lives. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah. And so what's the question?
I guess the question is, do you see anything saving us? And I don't mean saving us like just in the material sense, but I mean saving us in a spiritual sense as well. Like, I don't know. I know you've been doing this work your whole life, basically. I mean, you've written over 20 books. You've talked about this with numerous people. And I feel like you have a certain perspective that I don't have, or a lot of people have for that matter. So I guess maybe the question is there anything, do you see that there's any force or any sort of, I don't even know how I'm trying to phrase this exactly, but is there something that's going to make us wake up, even if it means that, you know, we're not going to be able to save ourselves, but we can at least see ourselves as we really are before the end comes. Does that make sense?
I used to have a fantasy that on a completely wasted world, there would be, you know, I could say to a capitalist, look what you did, and he would go, I'm sorry, but that's a fantasy. It's not going to happen. There's a great line from a terrible movie. It's A Boy and His Dog, or A Dog and His Boy, I don't remember which, written by Harlan Ellison. It's a terribly misogynist movie. It's a horrible movie. And there's a great line that perfectly describes this culture. It's a post-apocalyptic world where there are very few women, and the women that the men encounter get raped to death pretty quickly. And the movie starts off with this guy and his dog are wandering around, and he sees a woman who was raped to death, and he says something to the effect of, oh, that's so terrible. Man, why'd they do that? She still had a couple uses left in her. And that is going to be the feeling at the end, is the capitalists and the people, the civilized in general, are going to be upset because this world betrayed them by not allowing them to conquer every last little bit of it. There will be aggrieved entitlement. There will be narcissistic rage. And I mean, sure, there are some people who get it. And I mean, so give me a threshold. What is the point at which you think people would get it? Would you think it'd be 50% of the large fish in the oceans being gone? How about 60%?
Hmm.
How about 70%? 80%? 90%? It's already 90% of the large fishing oceans are gone. And what I see is things accelerating. Oh, here's a great example. I was thinking about, I've gotten really excited the last 6 months. I've been doing this little experiment because I read that mealworms can digest styrofoam. And I used to have mealworms when I was a kid, and I think they're kind of cool, and I love bugs. So I got myself a couple of, I bought myself some mealworms. And they are indeed eating styrofoam. It's pretty fun. And then I've been thinking about plastics and how I did a little thought experiment. So I just did this like a week or two ago. So, you know, plastics are a huge problem. They're killing the oceans. They're a terrible, terrible problem. They don't biodegrade. And the point of plastics is that they made something that would not degrade and or would not decay, would not rot. And what rotting or decaying means is somebody else is eating it. That's how decay works. You die, I die, and then bacteria is going to eat us, vultures are going to eat us. That's how you decay. If you have a wood house and the wood decays, what's happening is that fungus is eating. Okay, so we're all worried about plastics being, what would happen if some bacteria developed the ability to eat plastics at a speed that would be so great that it would actually save the planet from plastics? So it starts eating all the plastic trash. We're so excited. It's great. But the problem is that this wouldn't distinguish, the bacteria wouldn't distinguish between what plastic you threw away and what plastic is still in your kitchen. And yeah. All of a sudden, the plastic pots that you're carrying plants around in are decaying. And your steering wheel's decaying. And your computer's decaying. And your television's decaying. We have a huge emergency. We have to make new plastics that will not decay. So my point is that all the indicators are the wrong direction. I mean, seriously, how many people, even with global warming happening, I'm not even talking about people who don't believe global warming is happening, what percentage of people who recognize that global warming is a problem, I mean, all the mainstream solutions to it are they take industrial capitalism as a given, and they are trying to save industrial capitalism. And, you know, Bill McKibben and I have had this conversation where no one has done more work raising awareness of global warming than Bill McKibben. I'm going to give him that. That's absolutely true. No one has been more tireless. He is absolutely relentless on raising the issue of global warming. He has been for 25 years. That's wonderful. But I said to him, it's like, I wish that you were saying you wanted to protect the planet instead of civilization. Because he writes again and again, last chance to save civilization. Last chance to save, you know, we need to save this. He's not talking about saving the birds. He's not talking about saving the bats. And he gets it. He gets the global, how bad global warming is. And Naomi Klein, in her film, the film version of This Changes Everything, she actually says, polar bears don't do it for her. That this is us.
Yeah.
And so, and they're the ones who get it. They're not the Trumps. You know, they're not the Tom DeLays. They're not the, what's the guy from Oklahoma who is so, can't remember his name right now, but he's just terrible on global warming. They're not.
Oh, Inhofe, I think is his name. Yeah.
Yes, yes. How could I forget him? What a horrible
person. Yeah, the guy that brings a snowball into in Congress and throws it and says, hey, there's no global warming. Well, that kind of logic,
I'm talking about the people. So, no, I don't think part of the problem is that to understand this culture, we have to understand the logic of addiction. You know, it's like a lot of – there are heroin addicts who have recognized how bad the road is that they're going down, but they still – you know, I used to teach at a prison, and I had students say to me, you know, drugs cost me my children. They cost me the love of my life. They cost me my freedom. And if you put drugs on the table and a syringe, I would inject them within 30 seconds. And, I mean, they said that to me, you know. I mean, I had students who were about to get released from prison, and they're like, I'm really scared, because when I get out of here, I know I'm going to end up back on drugs, and I don't know what to do, because what do I do? I'm married, and my wife and my our courtship was based on taking drugs together. That's what we did. And I can't go back to her because she still takes drugs. My family, we took drugs together. I can't go back to my family. I can't go back to my friends because we all took drugs together. And I don't want to live under a bridge. What, I mean, one guy literally said all that to me. He said, I don't know what I'm going to do when I get out of here in a month. And it's the same with capitalism. The entire system is aiming you toward, I mean, for God's sake, there's the thing at the beginning of the book that says, you know, throughout this book, I have used the word who to describe non-humans as opposed to the word that. And I didn't have a big fight, but I had to fight my editor for that, my publisher for that. But that was the first question he raised after he read the book and was editing it and had edited it. When he, you know, when we were both sitting there with our manuscripts in front of us, and he said, so, on the phone, he said, so the first thing to address is the who that question. He said, it's very uncomfortable to use the word that, to use the word who to describe a tree. And I said, this is not negotiable. That's not going to happen. So we can just go to the next step. But the point is, and he was fine with that. But the point is, it was raised. And the point is, if you have a word processing system, it uses the word that to describe non-humans. I mean, people laugh out loud when, I mean, try this sometime, but don't try it if you don't want people to laugh at you. Say, I mean, how did you feel? And be honest about this. How did you feel? Did you feel a little bit weird when I said I was walking through the forest and the tree said to me, you know, I asked the tree and the tree said that back? That seemed a little strange.
I mean, initially, yeah, I mean.
It's okay if it does. It seems strange, frankly, you know?
Yeah.
I feel weird when I say it. I feel like, oh, I'm one of the, I mean, for God's sake, you know, having written all this, I've gotten so many emails over the years from people saying, oh, Derek, I'm making this up, but it'd be like, I know, I mean, the trees talked to me true, and the trees said that we're supposed to be in a relationship. No, we didn't tell you that.
I guess we associate that type of language with, I think we associate when you say things like that, that kind of language with somebody who's a little,
crazy.
A little, yeah, crazy. And what the way that you phrase that and, you know, having this conversation with you, and I'm sure if I were to get to know you as a person in real life, I wouldn't think that about you at all. I would be like, oh yeah, he's just referencing this experience he had with another sentient living being.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's the thing is here's a story I love to tell is that, so I've known my mom for, I'm 56. I've known her for 56 years, 56 years, 9 months, I guess. I was over at her house one day doing laundry, and after I did the laundry, I was folding the towel, and she said, would you like some help? And that's what she said, would you like some help? What I heard emotionally is, Derek, you're folding them wrong. Let me show you how to do it right. So the conversation went, would you like some help folding those towels, Derek? No! I'm like, okay. We've known each other for 56 years. We are both human beings. We both speak English. And still there was that tremendous projection on my part. So if there's that much projection, and think about this, you know, you have two people who are starting a relationship, and one of them says to the other, I love you. And the other person's like, what does that mean? You know, it's like, that can mean, does that mean you want to have sex with me? Does that mean you are enjoying this time with me? Does that mean you want to be really good friends with me? Does that mean you want to live with me for the rest of your life? What does that mean? And so even that's with two people who speak English. So just think if you were hanging out with somebody who only spoke, you only speak English, let's say, and they only speak Portuguese, and you start talking, how much of projection is there going to be there? And then what if it's that you speak human and they only speak dog? I mean, if you've ever had a dog or a cat, you know when they're trying to tell you something. If a water dish runs out, you know, the dog looks at the water dish, looks at you, looks at the water dish, and you figure it out. And with the cats, it's so funny. They will be somewhat affectionate, but I know if they're like over the top affectionate, if they're like chasing me around, purring, it's like, okay, what do you want?
Right.
So they can still communicate, but there's a lot of room for projection. It's like, do you want water? Do you want food? Do you want petting? Do I need to change the key litter box? What's the deal? And so just think, I mean, I'm walking through the forest. There is tremendous room for projection. Maybe I just thought it. I don't think so. I think that the tree told me that. But then again, I gotta tell you that if I'm walking down the path and the tree tells me that, Derek, you're supposed to pick up a gun and go shoot somebody at the post office, I would think, no, this is not the tree telling me this. This is, I need some meds, you know, this is.
Right.
So the point is that whenever we have this conversation, we have to be really, really, it's really important to me at least that when I have these sorts of conversations, they still be hard-headed and they not be, and we still demand evidence. You know, it's, here's the thing. I can't say the tree told me this. Whether the tree told it to me or not is desperately important in terms of my own epistemology and in the epistemology that I perceive in the world, but it is also completely irrelevant to whether the message that I got from the tree is true or not. What is important is the quality of the message itself, and it is simply true that if you consume the flesh of another and don't take responsibility for the continuation of our community, that they will, if you consume the flesh of another with no thought for the continuation of the other community, you will drive them extinct. You will, if you have the power, as we do as a culture. So I remember I said this, it was very cool. One of the first times after I had that conversation, when I was doing talk, and I said the thing about the predator-prey relationship, there was an American Indian guy in the audience. It was a Kahlo guy. And as soon as I said that, he was just nodding vehemently. And I use the example, if I consume flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I take responsibility for the continuation of the community. Responsibility, by the way, comes from the root meaning, is from the root respondere, which means to give in return. So this works perfectly down the line. Anyway, I said this, and he came up to me afterwards and was saying, you know, I'm so glad you said that, because that is our fundamental attitude, and that's one reason we were able to live here for so long without killing the salmon. Is we're perfectly aware at every moment that we owe them. We owe them. Because I'm consuming your flesh, I owe you everything. I owe you my life. And so that's the point. The point is that we can have this we can have this conversation, and we can drop the tree out of it, and it still is true. That's, I guess, the thing I wanted to say.
Right. Yeah, I think that when you talk about that experience where you're potentially maybe communicating with this tree in some way, or you talk about the animals and how, you know, your dog or your cat is communicating with you in some way, I think what maybe a person who is thinking about it maybe in a mechanistic way, they would say something like, oh, you're just anthropomorphizing these other creatures. So you're projecting human emotions and human experiences onto this other creature. So it kind of allows you to have some sort of distance from what you think you may have felt or experienced with that thing. Cause I mean, I've had experiences where I've been on a walk with a friend and I wouldn't say that the trees that I was walking by were communicating with me exactly. Like I didn't get a direct or a message or anything, but there was this real, it made itself known to me, if that makes sense. Its presence was very obvious to me. Like walking past it, I'm like, that tree was basically saying, hey, I'm right here. Like pay attention to me for a moment. And then I looked at it and I couldn't really decipher a message out of that, but I definitely felt something was there, some sort of sentience, some sort of intelligence. And, you know, after that experience and, you know, I go home and I, you know, get on my computer or I'm doing things that I would normally do, I tend to think, oh, that was just my projection. You know, I tend to doubt my own experience. Because, you know, again, if I were to tell a friend, like, hey, I talked to a tree or something, they're like, oh, really? Did you go on a spirit quest and walk out into the forest and have a crate? You know, like, they're going to belittle me and I think a lot of times that we don't necessarily need to think of it in those terms. Like, if I'm having an experience with another non-human creature, we don't have to think of it like I'm just projecting human emotions onto that creature. I'm just experiencing that creature's intelligence as it is. And I think like maybe for a cat or a dog, which has been domesticated, you know, they've been sort of, kind of, I don't want to say designed exactly, although maybe in certain breeds that may be the case, but they're almost designed to be able to communicate with human beings more directly. versus, say, a tree, which is maybe the intelligence of a tree is a little more difficult to put in human terms, like the type of communication that they would give you. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And I would believe that the intelligence of a redwood, if a redwood tree were to communicate with us, that this would be more, it would be more difficult to hear a redwood tree than an apple tree because of exactly what you just said about domesticated animals. That we have a long history of coercing, really, the apple trees. Mm-hmm. And I want to mention for a minute the word anthropomorphize. That is, as you know, one of my sort of bugaboos. That why, you know, it's extraordinary that we're told never to anthropomorphize as people project their belief that the world is dead onto these other beings. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that humans have a monopoly on emotions, and I don't believe humans have a monopoly on sentience. So it seems really, it's fine that you use that word because it gave me a chance to do this, but right. that's not a word I ever use because I find it really offensive, because it is the essence of human supremacism, this notion that only humans have any of these feelings. And, I mean, we've all seen dogs laugh, and we may not recognize it as a laugh. It's like when they start panting so hard, they start coughing when they're really happy.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, is why is something considered sentient only by how closely it corresponds to us?
Right.
That's the problem too. And then one more thing that was brought up in the book, that Stefano Mancuso makes this point, that we are more easily able to talk about artificial intelligence than to talk about plant intelligence. If somebody says that the plant is intelligent, that's fine. But we routinely say, what did the computer program say?
Right.
What did the computer tell you to do? And one of the things he says is it's much easier for us to talk about artificial intelligence than plant intelligence because it fits into this whole human supremacist mindset that the computers are creations of us. And so it's okay for us to project sentience onto them. But really what we're doing, I mean, this is the kicker of the whole anthropocentric thing, is we have projected onto the natural world, okay, who, when they say the word ecosystem, ever thinks about the fact that they're anthropomorphizing because they're calling the world a system, which is machine language, like your computer system, like your stereo system, as opposed to like the ignition system on a car. John Livingston taught me that one. He never used the word system. He always used the word natural community. And so it's only anthropomorphization it's like it kills me. I wrote a book against zoos back 12 years ago or something, or 15, I don't know how long ago. And one of the big things on zoos is that the people who support zoos always tell you, don't anthropomorphize the animals. Just because they look sad doesn't mean they're sad. And they're always saying this stuff, except when it comes to, if you read the zoo, the sort of articles in favor of zoos, they'll say that, except in the next sentence they'll say, the grizzly bears are delighted in their new home and they're being couch because they're not doing it. It's like you only get to anthropomorphize. Oh, there's this great, terrible line. Before I wrote the zoo book, I went to the Detroit Zoo. I was in Detroit and I had to go to a zoo before I could do the book. And they have this, this little, console in front of a lot of the cages that you push it. And then there would be, this is for children to push. You push it, and then there would be this voice sing, all the animals in the zoo are waiting here just for you. Like, yeah, you don't anthropomorphize except when it serves your interest. But I want to go back really to the main thing about about the whole selfish gene theory, which is that, I mean, for God's sake, Richard Dawkins talks about us being, what is it, beast machines, lumbering robots. But how often does he get accused of anthropomorphizing for projecting machine language onto the natural world? There are plenty of criticisms I've seen and made of Dawkins, but so far as I know, I'm the only person who criticizes him for anthropomorphization that way. And that's what's really sad, is that if you say, you know, that tree doesn't want to be cut down, you're anthropomorphizing. But if you say that tree is basically a mechanistic means of drawing water up from the soil and drawing and has little leaf machines that convert solar energy to sugar. I mean, if you say that, everybody thinks you're perfectly sane. If you say, you know, this tree has been here for 1,000 years and I think it probably does not want to die, then you're a nut. And it's 10 after. I can go a few more minutes and then I got to head into town.
Okay, that is fine. I think we've been talking a little over an hour now, so I think we've had some really good points that were covered. So, yeah, Derek, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts. I appreciate you taking the time for me to pick your mind and ask you some questions and get your ideas on things. So, yeah, I don't want to keep you too long, so I really appreciate your work, and if I don't know if there's anything like that you're working on now, if you want to talk about that or not, I don't have to do that. If you don't have to do that, if you don't want to, of course.
Well, I've got a couple books. One of them is pretty much done, and it's going to go off to the printer pretty quickly. The publisher pretty quickly, and that's a book about how there is a battle for the soul or war for the soul of anarchism. And on one hand, you have the people who recognize that governments are mainly set up to serve the rich and that it's powerful people protecting their power. And that would be people like me or Guy McPherson or Ed Abbey or Ramsey Kanaan, Craig O'Hara, Peter Kropotkin for that matter, people who just have that, you know, I used to give talks a lot, and I asked thousands and thousands of people over the years, do you believe that the government takes better care of individual human beings or better care of corporations? Better care of humans in community or better care of corporations? Everybody said corporations. So it's like, if you understand that, why are there not more people who are anarchists? And that's the other half. So you have one group in anarchism who has that basic understanding that humans are capable of self-determination, and that's good. And then you have this other group who basically uses anarchism as an excuse for sociopathic behavior. And that you have the idea that just because those in power make rules that primarily benefit those in power, that means that there should be no rules for anyone. And so, for example, Anarchy Magazine has promoted pedophilia. Anarchy Magazine, United States.
Wow.
And you get other anarchists have promoted pedophilia. I got in trouble one time with a bunch of anarchists because I said that I don't have a. I was talking. I gave this talk about 20 minutes on how basically laws are made by and for the wealthy for the most part. And then one line, I had a throwaway line that was, that doesn't mean I have a problem with laws against rape, which makes perfect sense, right?
Right.
I got pilloried by many people in anarchy world for that. So that book is about how there is that, I think, a very important battle for the soul of anarchism between those groups. And that's one book. Another book is, and this one is actually going to come out just in a couple weeks, is a small book of collection of short stories on the subject of monsters that's illustrated. And I turned monsters on their head by I don't want to ruin any of the stories. Well, one story is kind of fun. It's about a philosophy graduate student who goes in to interview a vampire, and we end up, it's a competition to basically to see who can be more narcissistic, and more of the undead. Let's see, what's one that I can do without giving away a plot point? I've got one that's about a teenager who is, demon spawn. Her parents are two demons, and she's going to a regular high school, and all the kids tease her and call her demon spawn because she has a tail. And that's really a sweet little story about basically growing to accept who she is. And one more is there's a guardian angel. I'm not going to give away the ending, but there's a guardian angel who gives everybody really bad advice that gets them killed. That's
pretty. Wow.
And then the one more book, which is what I'm working on right now, is called Bright Green Lies, and that's about how solar is not going to save us, and in fact is really harmful for the natural world. Same with wind, and how they're basically, those are a couple things. One of them is that it's extraordinary that you have an entire movement. I can't think of any other movement where this has happened. An entire movement that has been turned into a lobbying arm for sectors of the capitalist, for industrial sectors of the capitalist economy. So, for example, you have 1 million people march in some city, and you ask them why they're marching, and they say, we're marching to save the planet. And you ask them what their demands are, and their demands are that they want subsidies for the solar industry.
Hmm.
Oh my God, that's a huge coup. And that, again, the solar industry is really, really a lot of that. I just saw an article yesterday that Shell is investing really heavily into solar. And it really, all of that is a response to peak oil as opposed to global warming. Because that's not going to help global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go into that in, you know, another interview or something if you want. But that's the three books I'm working on.
Definitely. Wow. You have a lot you're doing right now. That's amazing. I would love to have another conversation with you sometime here in the near future, maybe whenever. You know, I'm really interested in that book you're doing on anarchism, that storybook. I'm probably going to pick that up. I really like that as well. And also the solar industry book. So yeah, that's a lot of things that we can discuss for our next conversation, which I hope to have with you, sometime here soon.
Okay, great.
So thank you, Derek. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to Last Born in the Wilderness. Listen and subscribe to this podcast on SoundCloud and iTunes. Give this episode a like, write a review, and share. Any feedback and support for this podcast is greatly appreciated. Once again, thank you for your attention, and as the great psychedelic bard Terrence McKenna said, take it easy, dude, but take it. Thank you.